At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe. Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe. We fixed that audio problem. We're not going to tell you which one, but we did fix it. We are your probably better sounding podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, here today with the Chelsea episode. So I'm just going to let her take it over from here.
Just one of the problems. Yeah. Not all the other ones.
We can't focus on everything.
No, but we did fix one.
Gods. Yeah.
And if you could send us a donation somewhere, that would be great. We have nowhere to take donations yet, but we ought to just do that.
Send it in the mail. We're not going to tell you where. But
oh, yeah. Money order. Yeah.
Also, don't address it to Journey to the Fringe because it is not incorporated.
We're learning so many things.
Please don't incorporate it.
Oh, Nazis and UFOs go together like peanut butter and jelly, Nessie and the Loch Ness, and Bigfoot and blurry photos. As you may have put together by now, today we're diving headfirst into one of the holy grails in conspiracy lore, the bizarre and persistent theory that the Third Reich didn't just chase UFOs, they built them. Have you heard that before?
I have. And Chelsea, this may be a controversial opinion. Uh-huh. I feel like if we just address them as Nazis, it wouldn't be taken as seriously.
I think we found a loophole.
I think you just gotta say, because there is a rise in Nazi views, you just there gotta call them Nazis. Because that does not sound as mean in any
way. It doesn't. So I think that's a tip we shouldn't have just given. We should still probably just call them Nazis.
Oh, no, I mean, like, for people who are adhering to Nazi values, you call them Nazis, they will feel embarrassed.
That's true. And I do like that.
90% of their worldview is about them being taken seriously and looking authoritative and just putting fear into others. So calling them a Nazi, I think that works.
I do think it works, actually. I would be interested to see how hurt you get calling them that to a Nazi sympathizer.
Wonder if they, because generally when you call somebody a Nazi, there's going to be a fight about they're a Nazi. But I think that completely disarms them from defending themselves. Well, and you're like, wait, you're a Nazi, aren't you?
I don't know. I feel like they would accept it at that point. I mean, if you call someone a racist, that one's kind of a toss up. But if you're a Nazi and you like them, I think you pretty much own it. But that's enough Nazi talk. Today we're talking about
Nazis. We're talking about Nazis. And their UFOs.
Yeah. From secret Antarctica bases to supposed saucers in the skies over 1940s Germany, this episode explores how wartime science, Cold War paranoia, and fringe speculation, I said it, collided to give us one of the strangest stories history never officially told. Officially. Let's start at the beginning.
And by Chelsea, sorry, by history you mean history the concept, not history the channel. Because history the channel has definitely explored this.
Oh, so much. It's specifically a Nazi UFO channel, I think.
So I think we just need to clarify. History the concept, not the channel.
Yeah, that. So let's start at the beginning. I think this is actually covered in one of the first podcast episodes we did. The beginning being Foo Fighters.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was on the first episode.
I believe it was too, because
UFOs.
You don't have to go back and re-listen to that. Just trust us.
I'll just cover it right here. Don't go listen to it. In World War II, a variety of unusual and anomalous aerial phenomena were witnessed by both Axis and Allied personnel. I think that might mean not anybody but the Nazis. right?
I think so.
Axis and Allied.
Yeah. No, Axis is the Nazis. It's the Nazis. Yeah, I wasn't quite paying attention.
Okay, I'm learning things.
No, yeah, Axis. We do. Axis are the Italians and the Germans and the Japanese.
Okay, so they're and the Allies. Okay, so I was right.
Yeah.
Okay, my assumptions were right then. It was just words I didn't recognize, as happens quite often. If you remember back to our first-ish episode, the nonsense word for foo in Foo Fighters emerged in popular culture during the 30s, first being used by cartoonist Bill Holman, who peppered his Smokey Stover fireman cartoon character strips with foo signs and puns. So maybe today they would have used a word like skibbity or something
skibbity
like that.
Skibbity toilets in the skies over Ohio is what they would be called.
I'm pretty sure that's what they would be called. So the comic strip featured the catchphrase, where there's skibbity Ohio toilets, there's fire. It's foo. Foo sounds a lot better than that. Which led to the Foo Fighters.
When I type in foo signs, Chinese characters come up. Was this like an Asian connotation to
It
was? Because I was trying to see, because you said there were foo signs.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know if that's...
Smokey Stover. It very well could be racist. Foo signs, Smokey Stover. I don't see... Fighter of Foo.
I definitely... recognize this art style from Smokey Stover.
It has to be racist.
Yeah, it probably... Huh. Okay.
Interesting.
I never put that together.
Neither did I. Yeah, it's racist. Based on this image I just pulled up.
Okay.
As much as you would think for a 1930s comic. So, the comic strip featured the catchphrase, quote, where there's foo, there's fire, end quote. And Donald J. Mears, a radar operator in the 415th Night Fighter Squadron and a fan of the comic, is credited by his squadron as the one who named the mysterious aerial phenomena Foo Fighters. Also, how the Foo Fighters, the band, got their name. FYI.
I do just want to add, I spelt foo, F-U, which might have impacted what I was seeing. And Foo Fighters is spelled F-O-O. So this
I
might
should clarify.
Be on
That's how they're spelling it. F-O-O. However, I'm looking at these comics and I'm pretty sure it is still a little bit racist. Yeah, I mean,
it would also kind of make sense if you're saying like there's this foreign thing in the sky.
Yeah.
You might think it's Asian. I don't know.
And it's the 30s, so there's got to be a little bit of racism in practically everything just sprinkled in there.
If it ain't whiskey or racism, then it didn't exist in the 1930s through 50s.
Exactly. During a debriefing on November 27, 1944, after encountering a strange red ball of fire while flying, Mears, visibly shaken, referred to it as, quote, another one of those fucking Foo Fighters, end quote, referencing the comic he carried with him. That's kind of an obscure reference to make, though, to just a random person. So I'm surprised that it stuck. Because if the person had never seen the comic, they'd be like, what the fuck did you just say to me?
I don't know. Right? Sunday comics in the day were
I forgot about Sunday comics.
Yeah, they were the thing.
They don't have that anymore, do they?
I mean, man, those were the best. They still exist. They're just not Sunday comics anymore. Yeah. They're just online. I never thought they were that great. They were just something that if you had a newspaper, you looked at them because they were the best part of the newspaper,
of course,
especially as a child.
They were like the Saturday morning cartoons with Mike Sobel as the
In
the newspaper. Like, that was the equivalent. Because nothing else mattered in the newspaper.
Other than the games, too, which were on the same page.
Yeah. No, that was the only page you looked at as a child. So, as the misperceptions of troops in the heat of combat, others were taken seriously and lead scientists such as Luis Alvarez began to investigate them. In at least some cases, Allied intelligence and commanders suspected or assumed that Foo Fighters reported in the European theater represented advanced German aircraft or weapons, particularly given that Germans had already developed such technological innovations as V-1 and V-2 missiles and the first operational jet-powered Mi-262 fighter planes. A minority of Foo Fighters seemed to have inflicted damage to Allied aircraft.
Wait, did you say they were called the Mi-2?
Yeah. No, Mi-262.
Oh, okay. Sorry, that cut off there because I just found it really weird that later on the U.S. comes out with a plane called the U2. There's a Me Too and then a U2.
Like the much hated band that put an album onto everybody's iTunes.
Yeah, they did it.
People hated it.
I can't believe that The Edge and Bono figured out how to do it, but boy, how did they? I can't believe they gave us free stuff.
Okay, seriously, just Google the Me 262 aircraft right now. It's a flying shark. It's a flying whale. It's a sea creature, that's for sure. Am I right in saying that?
Oh, it was Messerschmitt Me 262. Okay. It looks like an ordinary World War II plane.
Yeah, just this looks like a flying shark.
Okay.
As someone who doesn't know anything about that.
It kind of reminds me of those bombers that they would draw like the shark mouth onto.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm looking
like that,
at.
Yeah.
Yeah. This third one with the shark mouth. Okay. I gotta go back to
Well, yeah, and this one is specifically painted like a shark. So
yeah.
I see where you're seeing it.
Now they all look like sharks. Okay. So I'm not going to spend much time on this one since we covered it in a previous episode that you probably shouldn't go back and listen to. But there are tons of sightings of these things. So here are a couple, just so you don't have to go back to listen to that episode. Charles R. Bastian of the U.S. 8th Air Force reported one of the first encounters with Foo Fighters over the Belgium-Netherlands area. He described them as, quote, two fog lights flying at high rates of speed that could change direction rapidly, end quote. During debriefing, his intelligence officer told him that two RAF night fighters had reported the same thing, and it was later reported in British newspapers. Another sighting, career U.S. Air Force pilot Dwayne Adams related that he had witnessed two occurrences of a bright light which paced his aircraft for about half an hour, then rapidly ascended into the sky. Both incidents occurred at night, both over the South Pacific, and both were witnessed by the entire aircraft crew. The first sighting occurred shortly after the end of World War II, while Adams piloted a B-25 bomber. The second sighting occurred in the early 60s when Adams was piloting a KC-135 tanker. So this one was South Pacific versus the other one was in Europe. Third, Senator Ted Stevens described an encounter from the time he was a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot during World War II. As recounted by Senator Harry Reid, quote, I was flying and there was an object next to me. I couldn't get rid of it. I slowed up. It was there. I sped up. It was there. I would dive. It would be there. I called. Nothing on radar, end quote. That's Foo Fighters. Next we're going to talk about for a little bit is ghost rockets. And ghost rockets were missile-shaped UFOs reported mainly in Sweden and nearby countries to Sweden in 1946 with about 2,000 sightings. Some confirmed by radar.
That's well after World War II, isn't it?
I don't know that. Is it?
World War II ended on September 2nd, 1945, but that's with the surrender of Japan. The Western Front ended in 43, I want to say.
Mm?
Oh, no. It ended in 45, though, for sure.
46. I'm right, so...
Huh. Okay. You know what? That does track, though, because once World War II ends, all the rocket scientists get kind of divvied out between Russia and the U.S.
Yes.
So this is likely Nazis in Russia doing it.
Yeah.
USSR.
They have about 2,000 sightings, some confirmed by radar and physical fragments. So they happened in 1946, and there's about 2,000 sightings that were logged between May and December 1946, which is huge. And peaks on 9 and 11 of August 1946. 200 sightings were verified with radar returns, and authorities recovered physical fragments which were attributed to ghost rockets. The ghost rocket reports were not confined to Scandinavian countries. Similar objects were also reported early the following month by British Army units in Greece, especially around... Greek is just as bad as any other language that we try to pronounce, especially English. Thessaloniki. In an interview on September 5th, 1946, the Greek Prime Minister Konstantinos Abdelderis likewise reported a number of projectiles that had been seen over Macedonia and Thessaloniki on September 1st. In mid-September, they were also seen in Portugal and then Belgium and northern Italy. The Greek government conducted their own investigation with their leading scientist, physicist Dr. Paul Santorinis, in charge. Santorinis had been a developer of the proximity fuse on the first A-bomb and held patents on guidance systems for Nike missiles and radar systems. Santorinis was supplied by the Greek army with a team of engineers to investigate what again were believed to be Soviet missiles flying over Greece. In a 1967 lecture to the Greek astronaut...
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Chemical Society broadcast on Athens Radio, Santorinis first publicly revealed what had been found in his 1947 investigation. Quote, "We soon established that they were not missiles, but before we could do anything more, the Army, after conferring with foreign officials, in brackets, presumably U.S. Defense Department, end bracket, ordered the investigation stopped. Foreign students from Washington flew to Greece for secret talks with me." Santorinis told UFO researchers such as Raymond Fowler that secrecy was invoked because officials were afraid to admit of the superior technology against which we have no possibility of defense. While many were likely meteors, especially during the Perseid meteor shower, others showed maneuverability inconsistent with natural phenomena. At the time, it was suspected that the rockets were Soviet tests of captured German V-1 or V-2 missiles from the Piene Munde facility. Due to security concerns, the Swedish Army restricted media from reporting specific details about the sightings.
Yeah, and it makes sense that a lot of this happened after World War II because, like, the Nazis just got rockets as the war was ending. Mm-hmm. So it was more so, it seems like, their connection to the USSR that led to this situation.
And that was brought up a little bit on what I said as well.
So, yeah.
Okay. I mean, they're a part of
still Nazis, nonetheless. Yeah.
Situation going on in Europe at the time with interesting things that are unidentifiable in the sky. I believe we covered that on the first of our episodes as well. And possibly another one, I think it was an air flap. Because this is a time when, I mean, planes are flying around during the war, but it was not, correct me if I'm wrong, we wouldn't have seen so many things flying around as probably around that time. So maybe it makes a point for misidentifying things or not.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, you got to remember too at that time, as you're kind of saying, is that there was nothing in the sky pretty much prior to World War II pretty much. So anything being tested in the sky would be like maybe your first time seeing something rocket through the sky.
Yeah.
So it is something that gets told about.
It's something to consider in all of this. Which brings me to my next portion, which is on flying discs. During the 1947 flying disc craze, which happened in conjunction with Kenneth Arnold's widely reported close encounter with the 9 crescent-shaped objects moving at high velocity over Mount...
Rainier, isn't it?
Rainier. That's the word. That's the mountain.
Yep.
Personnel of Project Sign, which was... there's a lot of UFO lore in here. The first U.S. Air Force UFO investigation group noted that the advanced flying wing aeronautical designs of the German Horten brothers were similar to some UFO reports.
It's so sad that we got flying saucers from that because, like, he clearly described them not in that shape in any way. It was like they were skipping, like, saucers over water or something like that.
Yeah.
And they took to
and
that,
so
not the
born.
Crescent-shaped object in the sky.
Not a CSO. Yeah, that is weird that that's what they... I mean, maybe it's catchier. We love to say it now. I can't even get my head around UAP. I always default to UFO.
I think I could have called it a flying crescent. I think that sounds
it's
better
true,
than
I
a flying saucer.
Yeah,
but the fact that we've said flying saucers so many times, Flying croissants.
No. Do you remember that commercial? They just used to poke him in the stomach and he'd be like, hoo-hoo-hoo.
Yeah, it made a new Simpsons show.
It's just because I like Crescent Roll.
And poking guys.
Yeah.
Right in the tum-tum.
Yep. You know, you just see some of the tum-tums that they just gotta be poked and they just gotta go.
They gotta be poked.
Yep. It's true. So, in 1959, Captain Edward J. Repelt, the first head of Project Blue Book, Project Science follow-up investigation, he wrote, quote, "When World War II ended, the Germans had several radical types of aircraft and guided missiles under development. The majority were in the most preliminary stages, but they were the only known craft that could even approach the performance of objects reported by UFO observers." And I know a lot of what we tied into our first episode with the history of UFOs was that these craft that they were seeing were the enemy, which brought up a significant security issue as well. So they were taken very seriously, which amounted to a lot of the secrecy around UFOs as well.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, there's only two things in the sky, people on your side and people shooting at you.
Yeah.
So you kind of assume if they're not on your side, they are going to shoot at you at some point.
Yeah, that's true. But little did we know there was a third option, which was aliens.
I mean, sure. I think there's still foo fighters.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. At that point, they're probably not thinking aliens. I mean, it might not even be aliens. It could be drones. It could be a time
It could
slip.
Be the Chinese.
It could be, yep, the Chinese. Vast underestimated at that time, let me tell you.
Mostly because they were getting destroyed by Japan.
While these early speculations and report fucking Japan, we've done many episodes on that too. Go check those out. Not
yeah, there's a lot. The first there's episode. Like three of them. Yeah.
We did a lot of Japan episodes.
Those are good. Go listen to those.
More to come, probably. We could do forever bad episodes about Japan. They're horrible. Just so you know, if you haven't listened to those, I'll just catch you up right here. They're bad. While these early speculations and reports were limited primarily to military personnel, the earliest assertion of German flying saucers in the mass media appears to have been an article that appeared in the Italian newspaper Two Giornali d'Italia in early 1950. So we got all these Foo Fighters and ghost rockets going on. Yep, 1950s after all of this is going on. And this is all weird to them. And this is the first time it's appearing in print. The tie to Germany here. First time ever. Written by Professor Giuseppe Belluzzo, an Italian scientist and a former Italian minister of national economy under the Mussolini regime. It claimed that, quote, types of flying discs were designed and studied in Germany and Italy as early as 1942. And Italy, that's the first time I've heard that, end quote.
Yeah, I've never heard the Italians.
No, I have never.
I've never thought of them of actually, like,
no.
Doing anything.
With UFOs. Never, ever.
No, just in general. They're kind of, you know, they're taking their siestas. They're taking over some of Africa, but, like, they're not doing much.
No. Well, they're painting, like, some pretty good art for a little bit.
They're making good food.
Yeah. Oh, delicious pizza and pasta. Some lemonade in Capri.
They got the mafia that, going on.
Yeah, yeah. They got the mafia running the Catholic Church. So that's important.
But not no UFOs as far
no,
as I'm aware.
No, absolutely no UFOs have ever crossed my mind. So Belluzzo also expressed the opinion that, quote, some great power is launching discs to study them, end quote. That same month, German technician Rudolf Schreiber gave an interview to German news magazine Der Spiegel, in which he claimed that he had designed a craft powered by a circular plane of rotating turbine blades 15 meters in diameter.
That's huge.
Yeah, it is actually, now that I think about it. That's 15 meter sticks. I have to think about that meter stick.
That's better than football fields.
That's pretty big. I would never think of it in a football field if it says meter.
We're talking about what? About quarter, 20% of a football field.
You know, if I was to measure, if I was to be measuring things by football fields, everything would be either bigger or smaller than a football field.
It is smaller than a football field.
Yeah, smaller than then. I'd have to look at it because 15 meters is definitely smaller than a football field. It's 15 meter sticks, by the way. He said that the project had been developed by him and his team at BMW's Prague Works until April 1945, when he fled to Czechoslovakia, which is now the Czech Republic.
No, it's not, Chelsea. You are behind. It is Czechia.
What?
Yeah, it renamed itself Czechia.
When?
Like a year ago.
Oh, you're right. 4 days ago.
It didn't do it 4 days ago. It was like a year ago.
It updated its status 4 days ago.
Okay.
His designs for the disc and a model were stolen from his workshop in Bremerhaven, Lehigh, in 1948. And he was convinced that the Czech agents had built his craft for, quote, a foreign power, end quote. In a separate interview with Der Spiegel in October 1952, he said that the plans were stolen from a farm he was hiding in near Regen on the 14th of May 1945. There are other discrepancies between the two interviews that add to the confusion of all of this, unfortunately. Yeah. In 1953, Avro Canada announced that it was developing the VZ9AV Avro car, a circular jet aircraft with an estimated speed of 2,400 kilometers an hour. I'm not giving miles per hour. That doesn't even make sense.
That's not David Wilcox company, is it?
Nope.
Okay.
Savati. Could you imagine? Savati Aerospace. German engineer. Oh, hold on. Colin McGeezer is David Wilcock, Australian guy.
Oh, God.
I forgot to tell you that on the mini.
Okay.
I'm sorry to bring it up here.
That he just breaks out into mid-hike.
Yeah. Sorry. I had to get it out because I totally forgot about it until now. German engineer George Klein claimed that such good designs had been developed during the Nazi era. Klein identified two types of supposed German flying discs. The first, a non-rotating disc developed in Brüsselau by V2 rocket engineer Richard Miethe, which was captured by the Soviets while Miethe fled to the US via France and ended up working for Avro. Second one, a disc developed by Rudolf Schriver and Klaus Herbermohl in Prague, which consisted of a ring of moving turbine blades around the fixed cockpit. Klein claimed that he had witnessed his craft's first crewed flight on the 14th of February 1945, when it managed to climb to 40,700 feet. In 3 minutes and attained a speed of 2,200 kilometers an hour in level flight. Miethe claimed he had worked on the V2 program, but no corroborating evidence exists. George Klein claimed the engineer had escaped capture by the Soviets in Breslau by flying out of Messerschmitt Mi-163 Komet. That's a weird, is that an address? Which would have been impossible.
That almost sounds like that airplane, does it not?
I don't. It does.
Isn't that the Messerschmitt Mi-262?
Yes, that is exactly what I think it's saying. By flying out in a Messerschmitt Mi-163 Comet, which would have been impossible. Okay. I said address when I meant plane.
Okay. There we go.
Thank you for catching that. There is no evidence that Habermohl even existed. Rudolf Schriver claimed he had worked for Henkel as a test pilot and engineer between 1940 and 1941, but this has never been corroborated. In post-war Germany, Schriver drove supply trucks for the U.S. Army, but told newspaper reporters that delegates from foreign powers were constantly making him offers regarding his wartime projects. Aeronautical engineer Roy Fedden remarked that the only craft that could approach the capabilities attributed to flying saucers were those being designed by the Germans toward the end of the war. Fedden, who is also chief of the technical mission to Germany for the Ministry of Aircraft Production, stated in 1945, quote, "I have seen enough of their designs and production plans to realize that if they, the Germans, had managed to prolong the war some months longer, we would have been confronted with a set of entirely new and deadly developments in air warfare," end quote. Fedden also added that the Germans were looking on several very unusual aeronautical projects, though he did not elaborate upon his statement. So that's what I have on the flying disc. And the next one that I have is, I think why everybody showed up here, is the D-Glock. I don't know how exactly you would D-Glock, say that.
Yeah.
The beautiful language, which is the mother tongue German.
The pure language.
The purest language that exists. Which means the bell in English. Do you know that English is a Germanic language?
It's both Germanic and Latin. It has a lot of...
I guess we do have
a lot of... Let's call them inspiration languages.
I was saying that English derives from Latin, and that is not entirely the right...
It does partially, and there's actually a movement, I forget what it's called, but to move English to its German roots for how we talk, and... In this, I forget the name of this movement, but in this, a geologist would be called a somebody who studies stone lore, which I really like.
Right. You've talked about this before.
Yeah, I know. I've said it before, I'm pretty sure, on this podcast.
And I don't know if you've actually heard someone speaking German, but I mean, German is a beautiful language to listen to someone speak. I've traveled, when I was in Switzerland, I was in the German-speaking portion of Switzerland, and I gotta say, some of the things that I saw posted around, I just thought were the most hilarious things. I don't have a specific example right now, because I can't ever give an example on the spot, but you gotta trust me on this one. So, the D-Glock was a purported top secret Nazi scientific technology device, secret weapon, Wunderwaffe. I guess I can't pronounce that first off. And it sounds like nobody could really grasp exactly what it was. For as much as you hear about the D-Glock, I was shocked, as always, to find out just how far back the evidence we have about the D-Glock goes. Here to take a gander, Taylor?
1998.
Close. You are so close.
I think it's
close.
Pretty recent.
2000.
Oh, man. I gave it too much credit.
Does that not blow your mind?
Like, did Discovery Channel uncover it by chance?
Okay, the funny thing about it is you said not to get confused with the History Channel, and I swear to God, that's where I consumed everything about the D-Glock, and it was probably around this exact time that I was watching stuff about it, and it was in immense volume.
Oh, that was like 90% of their shows on
History Channel. I took in so much Nazi UFO culture, it is crazy, which I think is why it's so popular as well, because of how many ties there is to it. 2000 is the first mention of the Glock.
That is crazy for an empire that fell 55 years earlier.
Yeah.
First mention.
Yeah. And doesn't it just track for the community, though? Doesn't it just be like, yeah, that seems right for everything that we've seen going on around UFOs and stuff like that, unfortunately. It blew my mind to see too. I had to double check that this was correct. So I went back and double checked all my sources, and it is in fact correct. That's it. We're going to learn about this guy, Igor, that I'm mentioning right now. Igor published his book in 2000, and it was published in 2003. And I don't think I talked about Igor yet, so I'm going to catch you up soon.
Oh, I'm excited to learn about Igor. He doesn't happen to be the guy who was 55 years earlier and finally had to break his... Was he?
No.
Okay.
So Igor Vitovsky claimed to have discovered evidence of the D-Glock in a review of World War II era documents that were declassified by the Polish government, which led him to additional research via archives and interviews. The first document, allegedly supplied to Vitovsky by an unnamed Polish government official, was an affidavit from the war crimes trial for General Jacob Sporenberg, who supposedly confessed to ordering the murder of about 60 persons who had knowledge of the secretive project.
So if it was part of a trial, there should be pretty clear, like... documentable evidence of this taking place.
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be this secretive document passed to you.
Yeah. 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 You're kind of on the right track.
Okay.
Kurt Diebus, Warner Braun Brown, and Walter Gerlach were also allegedly implicated in D-Glock research. Vitovsky claims D-Glock was organized under a division of the Waffen-SS and operated mainly at facilities in Lower Silesia. D-Glock was conceived in early 1942, and active experimentation began in mid-1944. Prisoners from the Gross-Rosen concentration camp were supposedly exposed to radiation from the Diglock, resulting in many deaths and health problems. Survivors of the camp are alleged to have reported witnessing tests of the Diglock, reporting a bright bluish light from the object. Vitovsky postulated cerium-525 was likely an iridated form of mercury used in the creation of a form of plasma that was intended as a weapon and or propulsion system and which may have been capable of distorting space-time. The information put out by Igor was later popularized by a dude named Nick Cook. You will not probably recognize Igor's name. I don't even recognize Nick Cook. But this guy is the one who kind of brought it all together. He grabbed the translated version in 2003 of Igor's book, and he's the one that associated it with Nazi occultism, anti-gravity, and free energy suppression research.
Now, the only thing missing at this point is the Hutchison effect being used to state that's how it's moving around.
But we knew there had to be an asshole in here somewhere, right?
Yeah.
To tie it all together.
When you say 2000s, yes, it definitely has to be an asshole.
So Cook described Vitovsky's claims of a device called the Bell, engineered by Nazi scientists, that was, quote, a glowing rotating contraption, end quote, rumored to have some kind of anti-gravitational effect, be a time machine or part of an SS anti-gravity program for a flying saucer. Also, according to Cook, Diglock was bell-shaped, about 12 feet high and 9 feet in diameter, and incorporated two high-speed counter-rotating cylinders filled with purplish liquid metallic-looking substance that was supposed to be highly radioactive, named cerium-525.
That is teeny tiny compared to those 15-meter ones.
It's true, yeah. So definitely,
was it like, going to grow into a 15-meter bad boy at some point?
You gotta hope. Cook recounts claims that scientists and technicians who worked on the Bell and who did not die of its effects were wiped out by the SS at the close of the end of the war, and the device was to an unknown location. Cook proposed that the SS official Hans Kammler later secretly traded this technology to the US military in exchange for freedom. Vitovsky suggested that a concrete ring called the Henge near the Wenceslaus mine, built in 1943 or 1944, and vaguely resembling Stonehenge, was used to tether the Bell during tests. According to writer Jason Calavito, the structure is merely the remains of an ordinary industrial cooling tank.
Man, Chelsea, I just need to say this at this point.
Yeah.
That I basically feel like I've heard this story.
Yeah.
Because Tom DeLonge wrote a book. And by wrote a book, he told somebody, an author, a story he wanted to be written.
Yeah.
And then the author wrote the book on his behalf.
Yeah.
And there's an escaped Jewish individual who was in a concentration camp, and he basically tells this story as to like how he escaped.
What?
Yeah, I think it's called Hidden Machines or something that.
Not the first one or something. Yeah.
And yeah, this is basically the story in there.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
I found this super disappointing because this is lore that I pretty much grew up with.
Took for granted that it's
and
just
I
like,
took
yeah.
Took for granted.
There's,
totally.
There's something. And anybody who watched the History Channel at that time, yes.
Yeah.
This is what you just assumed that, like, oh yeah, it goes back to the Nazis.
So I'm going to say right now, Nazi occultism and this Nazi UFO are totally different subjects that get tied together. I mean, we could thank this Nick Cook, probably.
You can at least tie occultism with the Nazis back to the 1980s, because that's what the Indiana Jones movies are about.
Yes, specifically from the Indiana Jones
movie. Yeah. So you can at least put it 20 years earlier.
Yes. So I was super disappointed to learn this, as I usually am by our episodes. Mind blown.
Mine too.
We've covered Nazi occultism in very indirect ways in different episodes. It might be worth another episode in the future. Maybe there's other podcasts that do a really good job on Nazi occultism. Maybe we'll cover it.
And once we cover the next lost continent, we'll probably cover it, because that'll then tie it to the genocide that then takes place.
Yeah. We've covered a lot of Nazi UFO connections already, and there's tons more of Nazi connections that I didn't quite get to on this one. Some of them we have done previous episodes on. Some of them might be future episodes. We know how much you guys love Nazi UFO stuff and connections and conspiracy theories. So we're probably not going to stop doing it. This one apparently appears to be BS. Not that they weren't experiencing something mysterious over the skies, but it was still very new. Like we learned in our brief history of UFOs, this was all very new technology. So while pilots are these experienced people piloting aircrafts and know what to be looking for, at the time, this was all very new technology.
They were, the pilots in World War II were kids reading the newspaper when the first flight happened.
As we saw from how Foo Fighters got their name.
They probably flipped past that one right to the comics.
This one can very, very easily be explained away. I want to believe the best about the Foo Fighters and what was very weird with the ghost rockets. Yeah, I'll believe it. I can't continue on with the dialogue any further, unfortunately. I just want to cover a few conspiracies that we get out of this if you want to go further and that we may go further on. This one we've covered. Nazi Germany claimed the territory of New Swabia in Antarctica, and they sent an expedition there in 1938 and planned others. Yes, we did this on Admiral Byrd, and his team were attacked by a fleet of UFOs. Go back. I don't even know what it's called. I don't even know when we covered it. We've done it, though.
I think it's Nazis in Antarctica is what that episode's called, but I can't remember when.
No, neither can I. You better just start from episode, like, 4 and just go back from there.
Yeah.
Flying saucers were Nazi secret weapons launched from an underground base in Antarctica, from which the Nazis hoped to conquer the Earth and possibly the planets. Miguel Serrano wrote a book which claimed that Adolf Hitler was an avatar of Vishnu and was, at that time, communing with Hyperborean gods in an underground Antarctic base in New Swabia. Serrano predicted that Hitler would lead a fleet of UFOs from the base to establish the Fourth Reich. In popular culture, this alleged UFO fleet is referred to as the Final Battalion. Lots to do with Nazis in Antarctica. I always thought it was like a, not fun, but interesting mind experiment to think about, like, what if they did escape? Because there's all this, like, Nazi submarines and military machinery that went missing at the end of the war.
Well, that end, a lot of them ended up in Argentina. Like, we just know that.
But what if, like, all this machinery went missing? The machinery probably didn't go to the United States and Argentina. What if they escaped with it to Antarctica and they had a base there? That was just like, as Nazis escaped to Antarctica and they just grew this super high-tech UFO Nazi technology civilization. It's like a sci-fi thought. Like, that's pretty cool if that, not pretty cool if it happened. Obviously, it would be devastating for the Earth. Very devastating for humanity. But to think of that, and Admiral Byrd comes into play with that because he supposedly went to Antarctica to see what's up and he was attacked by Nazi UFOs. It's a whole thing. You got to listen to whatever episode. But it's an interesting thing to think about. That's probably not what happened. We'd probably have evidence of them doing that by now.
No. But, in fact, they probably escaped to Argentina.
Where they hold their little Nazi festival in what maybe...
That was spring. In Brazil.
Oh, yeah. What? Okay, so just they're there in South America. Then there's the theory that just so many theories about... I mean, that doesn't even have to do with UFOs, that Hitler is in South America, most likely dead by now, but he was probably alive for a little bit. I gotta think that there's so many conspiracies around the... Okay, next UFO Nazi connection we got going on. Nazi Germany conducted research into advanced propulsion technology, including rocketry, Victor Schoenberg's engine research, Horton flying wing craft, and Arthur Sack AS-6 experimental circular wing craft. I don't even know what that sentence means. It's in the notes. So, next point. Also added to the list is that the Nazis may have made contact with an alien race and dedicated itself to creating spacecraft to reach the aliens in partnership with the Thule Society and the Nazi Party. The Vril Society developed its flying disc prototype. With the Nazi defeat, the Society allegedly retreated to a base in Antarctica and vanished into the Hollow Earth, which we covered in the Hollow Earth episode, I'm pretty sure, to meet up with the leaders of an advanced race inhabiting inner. So there we have it. A brief history of UFOs and the Nazis and kind of where it spirals from there. I hope we wrapped our mind around that. I know it's a lot to take in because I know I blew a lot of people's minds about not finding out about the Glock until the 2000s.
I know. That is a huge turn of events in my mind because it's always been just kind of a given that that's part of UFO lore.
You would think, looking back on it, it was just something that you assume was a known thing to do with the Nazis.
They show, architecture or design schematics for it on those shows. And you're like, oh yeah, those are probably from the 40s or the 30s, whenever they were developed.
It's known as long as the Nazis have been known.
Yeah.
Just as long, I think the Antarctic conspiracy theory goes back further than this theory.
Oh, way further, because they actually did at least go to Antarctica. Yeah,
they actually, that's why that conspiracy theory persists, because the Germans actually wrote news articles about Neuschwanstein and how they visited there. So at least there's a starting point for this, where this one just comes out in the 2000s, which is super fucked up. But yeah, that's my Nazi UFO episode. And it took us on a wild ride, I feel like.
Yeah, and I'm saddened that yet another piece of lore gets ruined in UFOs for us. But that's... every time you dig into something, it just gets ruined.
I know! It's just... You know what? I have to state it right now, though, on the record. It doesn't stop me from believing.
No,
it just stops me from believing in this.
Well, and it doesn't stop me from wanting to learn about it either.
No, I know, right? I want to learn more. But I'm still believing, just not that the bell was something that the Nazis actually had, which is probably a good thing in the end. We have to think about it positively, right?
Yeah.
It's probably good that they did not have that.
Yeah, and they weren't, had the war gone on like 20 more minutes, sending out their UFO fleet.
Yeah. Right, so it's a good thing. It's a good thing that this was fake. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always a disappointment. Always entertaining here at Journey to the Fringe.
And with that, I have been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes, or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.